This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about the new book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States.
From the start, there was imperialism, from sea to shining sea.
We're joined by Professor Stephen Saleta to talk about the latest update in his academic freedom case.
He was hired and then fired for criticizing the Israeli massacre in Gaza. They called him uncivil.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
In the United States today, there are more than 500 federally recognized indigenous communities and nations comprising nearly 3 million people. These are the descendants of the 15 million people who once inhabited this land and are the subject of the latest book by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. In An Indigenous People's History of the United States, Dunbar Ortiz challenges the founding myth of the United States and shows how policies against the indigenous peoples were genocidal and imperialist, designed to crush the original inhabitants. Spanning more than 300 years, this classic bottom-up history significantly reframes how we view our past. Told from the viewpoint of the indigenous, it reveals how Native Americans for centuries actively resisted expansion of the U.S. empire. We're joined now by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Roxanne.
Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
We wanted to start by posing a question that you yourself actually raise in the book, namely, how might acknowledging the reality of U.S. history work to transform society?
Well, one friend of mine, a young historian who teaches Navajo students in Arizona in a rural school, I think said it best that it's not sufficient but necessary to make a movement in the United States and actually change the world. It's absolutely necessary to know this history of settler colonialism and how it affects consciousness today of U.S. people and in the world, because everyone is convinced of this myth of the United States. And somehow it's always just going off the path of this destiny that has never been true in the first place. You know? So it's like a fairy tale, and only it's extremely deadly and dangerous, unlike stories you just tell for excitement or whatever. And many other countries have romantic myths as their form of nationalism, but they don't control the world with this ideology.
And what are some of those myths specifically?
Well, the myth is that it was a birth of democracy. It was a birth of settler democracy. But we know, say, from apartheid South Africa, we know from colonialism, but particularly settler colonialism, such as Israel, that this idea of being destined, the settler destiny. In fact, there are so many parallels with Israel because the Puritans, and then this became embedded in all settlers, had this idea of the New Jerusalem, of Zion. They used that terminology that God had given them this land to settle. It wasn't just a right, it was a responsibility to destiny, to the world. So this was a core idea. This made, of course, transforming the native farmers, fishermen, ordinary people like other people in the world into savages and monsters, sort of like the Israelis do Palestinians today. It's kind of odd that I find in explaining U.S. history that people know more about Israel and Palestine than they do about U.S. history. So I can bring up these examples, and then it kind of clicks. Oh, yeah, it's very similar. You know, if you look at the maps of the shrinkage of native land compared to Israel, and, you know, and our, most of us remember, you know, from that time, or I was 10 years old when Israel was founded. So it's a reality, but it's just history when it comes to the United States. It's gone, it's done. But it's not. It feeds into, throughout the book, I have a theme of the militarism and the counterinsurgency, which attacks civilians and food fight, they call it, burns the food supplies, the crops, burns the houses of the people in their towns, creates refugees, that this then becomes a pattern. Richard Slotkin calls it a regeneration through violence, that every generation there's this Indian war. Vietnam looked like an Indian war. Even the language they use, Indian country for any enemy territory, all of the weapons they name after Native people. This carries on. I mean, it gets a little bit psychological, but it has the material base of imperialism and accumulation and power and control. But it's also deeply militaristic, unlike any empire before it, that almost compulsively militaristic. And this is not how we think of the United States as supposedly a civilian country. The military is always under control of civilians. But that civilian president is commander-in-chief of the armed forces. You know? That's not common. The prime ministers of most countries are not the commanders-in-chiefs of the armed forces.
Yeah, well, we've had a tenure discussion on that since right after 9/11. It's a problem to have a democratic country when the president is also the general. Right. And you can see it now, of course, with Syria. But let me get back to the settler colonial enterprise that was launched when the Puritans set foot in Massachusetts. And talk to us about what kind of society these Europeans found on this continent. How many people lived here? What was their culture like? How did it compare to Europe, say, west of the Ural Mountains? What was it like, and what did they do to it?
Well, this is the mythology, is to reduce the population to either non-existent or Neolithic hunters roaming around in untouched forests. Whereas it's the exact opposite, is out of 9 centers of civilization, that is agricultural, the development of agriculture and being able to support large population, 3 of those are in the Americas, the Andes, actually 4, the Andes, central Mexico, and the southeast and northeast of North America. And this, there's also a theory of the Bering Straits, only one entrance to the whole continent, which is absurd because all of the people on the coast were great seafaring people. It's odd that we know in the Pacific everyone was all over the place in boats, you know, populating all the islands. But somehow all those people along the coast of the Pacific or Atlantic, just they were afraid of the water or something, you know. They weren't out there exploring or going to India or Africa and vice versa. So a part of European imperialism, say, is the beginning of everything, you know, that it connected people up. And actually what it did was separate people from each other and their traditional. But the most impressive thing for me doing this research, I knew my specialization is the Southwest and Central Mexico, Central America. And everyone knows that's a highly, I mean, you can't really deny the pyramids and the great cities that 30 million people in central Mexico, whereas there were only 50 million people in all of Europe up to the Ural Mountains, 30 million just in central Mexico, and 100 million in the whole hemisphere. So I knew there were complex trade routes and roads all over the place. Canals, you know, irrigation canals, highly developed agriculture. But to learn, and in this first chapter, Follow the Corn, I did just that. I followed out of Mexico this dispersion of corn agriculture all the way to Tierra del Fuego and to the subarctic and from coast to coast. these agricultural civilizations. What was different about them, which is very interesting, is that the idea of Oriental despotism, that when, you know, great civilizations and cities develop, that class systems develop. Marx adopted that idea of Oriental despotism. But they didn't know really anything about the cultures of the Americas. And what you find in the Americas is when they get to the point of, say, abusing the environment, of becoming dictatorial or whatever, there tends to be revolts that overthrow those. That was happening when Cortez came to Mexico. The Quetzalcoatl cult that took over the Mexico government, the Aztec government, became abusive, and it was doing slave raiding, had done a wonderful job of dispersing all kinds of trade routes. And so there was Cortez simply allied with the rebels and overthrew the central government. Of course, they couldn't have known his intentions of simply wiping out their whole civilization. And
can you talk a bit, Roxanne, about the commodification of land?
Yes, this is, of course, land in the Americas was whatever the, I mean, there were hundreds of different kinds of polities and governance and arrangements, but in all cases, and I think this was true of the whole world, not just the Americas, collective land ownership. It's more practical. It's more brings people together. It takes a burden off, you know, a certain class of people just doing all the work. It just makes for better democratic principles. So I think it was kind of common sense to human beings. But with this, you know, and I think, you know, no one better than Marx brings, you know, the understanding of capitalism being a more recent development. But in the United States, I mean, clearly there was the accumulation of capital, the prior accumulation of capital with the looting of the Americas. But when British colonialism came to North America with these peculiar characteristics of the Puritan ideology settling in, with it, with two centuries of settler colonialism, they developed this idea of ownership. And I think it was really, it went from owning human beings to the idea of owning the land, not the reverse, of private property in human bodies and in land. Because it was almost unimaginable before. There was control of territories. There was enclosure of the commons, of course, was the preliminary step to that. But in the Americas, it took the turn of, you know, creating this idea of real estate and cutting everything into these rectangular plots of 160 acres and sections. And in the Northwest Ordinance, which preceded the Constitution during the War of Independence that created the United States, they actually mapped out. They had been doing surveying. George Washington was a surveyor, and you have to ask, why was such a wealthy, super wealthy planter a lowly surveyor? But surveyors got to choose the best land, you know, and mark it up. And they had already developed this plat, you know, this idea of creating territories and that would then become states once they had a majority settler population. That's why it took so long for Oklahoma. Oklahoma was the 47th state, New Mexico, Arizona, these places that had a majority native population until they could get enough settlers there. That's why I think they'll never allow Puerto Rico to be a state, even if Puerto Ricans wished it, which I don't think they do.
We're speaking with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, who's written an Indigenous People's History of the United States. I just want to read what the great scholar Robin Kelly said about the book for all you out there. Professor Kelly wrote, "This may be the most important U.S. history book you will read in your lifetime." Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz radically reframes U.S. history, destroying all foundation myths to reveal a brutal settler colonial structure and ideology designed to cover its bloody tracks. Here, rendered in honest, often poetic words, is the story of those tracks and the people who survived, bloodied but unbowed. Spoiler alert, the colonial era is still here, and so are the Indians. Roxanne, you're part Indian. I wanted to ask you how you came to this point, growing up poor in Oklahoma, embracing your Indian past and becoming the scholar you are. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I didn't embrace my my mother's heritage because she didn't. I always say my mother was marrying up when she married my father, who was a sharecropper, you know, so white sharecropper. It was rough being, you know, native in the United States. It still is, unless you're, you know, more privileged. But a lot has changed with the native movements. There's respect and there's kind of wannabe, but no one was a wannabe back then. I grew up in Canadian County, Oklahoma. My dad sharecropped and was a tenant farmer throughout that area until, you know, the Depression wiped out. The people went to California as refugees, you know, the story, the really poor. They weren't the really poor. They were the farmers who owned land that my dad used to say, we didn't have enough money to go to California. We were too poor. But it did throw all the tenants and sharecroppers, many of whom were black. They were black, white, and Indian sharecroppers, off the land into, you know, jobs. So I got to know settler culture very well without being conscious that that's what it was until later. So later when I was sort of drafted into the American Indian Movement, recruited because I was part Indian, and I was doing, you know, promoting ethnic studies and Native American studies as a historian, I'm very cautious about the identity because Native nationalism, you know, it goes by, you know, Cherokee or Onondaga or Shawnee, Creek, Muscogee. And my mother was an orphan. There are many, many people who were, of course, refugees and orphans and on the frontier and really, really sad situation. My mother grew up as a street kid, and then she was put into an Indian juvenile facility run by the Southern Baptists. So she became a very hardcore Southern Baptist, and I was raised a hardcore Southern Baptist. But on my father's side, my grandfather had been active in the labor movement. He was in Oklahoma. He was a socialist in the Socialist Party, and he was in the Wobbly. He was in. He named my father, who was born in 1907, he named him Moyer Haywood Scarberry Pettibone Dunbar. And so I heard these stories because of the name. I say, now how did you get your name? And he would tell me about his father fighting the Ku Klux Klan and the big wheat farmers and the mining companies. Because Oklahoma is very industrialized, petroleum, mining, and agribusiness, wheat, went from cotton fields to wheat, which was from the onset mostly mechanized. So the Wobblies organized mainly the migrant workers, and the Socialist Party in Oklahoma organized mainly the tenant farmers and the sharecroppers. And there was an instance in 1917 that I think is one of the most important moments in U.S. history, and hardly anyone knows about it. Jack Womack and I have written about it in Monthly Review. It was the Green Corn Rebellion. And this was where tenant farmers and sharecroppers, Native American, mostly Muscogee, Creek, African American, and white, rose up together against conscription. They had learned enough. They were mostly illiterate, but they had learned enough from the Socialist Party being there and being so active, and the Wobblies, to call this a rich man's war, imperialism. Of course, they were dependent on their young men to work, to feed the family, you know, the taking them away. I mean, they had a material self-interest, but they also had this idea of fighting conscription. Of course, they were defeated, but to me, it's like the uprising in Chiapas, you know, that global and local thing, and very few people know about it. I've done quite a lot of writing. I have a kind of split personality because I'm half settler and, you know, half native. That's why I wanted to do this book, because it's an indigenous people's history of the United States, you know, where I could bring my knowledge of the kind of how the settler is screwed too, you know, and how important it is to, I find in Oklahoma with the young people who are children of settlers or, you know, descendants of original settlers, that they are so excited when they learn the truth of their own history. They don't feel guilt, you know, they feel excited, liberated.
Roxanne, you mention in your book that indigenous people offer possibilities for life after empire. Can you talk about what that might look like, how that process would unfold?
Well, I could read this last paragraph, which is the future.
We wish you would.
Yes, thanks. How then can U.S. society come to terms with its past? How can it acknowledge responsibility? The late Native historian Jack Forbes always stressed that while living persons are not responsible for what their ancestors did, they are responsible for the society they live in, which is a product of that past. Assuming this responsibility provides a means of survival and liberation. Everyone and everything in the world is affected, for the most part negatively, by U.S. dominance and intervention, often violently through direct military means or through proxies. It is an urgent concern. Historian and teacher Juan Gomez Quiñones writes, quote, American Indian ancestries and heritages ought to be integral to K-12 curriculums and university explorations and graduate expositions, with full integration of Native American histories and cultures into academic curriculums. Gomez Quiñones coins a measure of intelligence in the United States, the indigenous quotient. Indigenous peoples offer possibilities for life after empire, possibilities that neither erase the crimes of colonialism nor require the disappearance of the original peoples colonized under the guise of including them as individuals. That process rightly starts by honoring the treaties the United States made with indigenous nations, by restoring all sacred sites, starting with the Black Hills, and including most federally held parks and land, and all stolen sacred items and body parts, and by payment of sufficient reparations for the reconstruction and expansion of Native nations. In the process, the continent will be radically reconfigured, physically and psychologically, for the future to be realized. It will require extensive education programs and full support and active participation of the descendants of settlers, enslaved Africans, and colonized Mexicans, as well as immigrant populations. In the words of Acoma poet Simon Ortiz, the future will not be mad with loss and waste, though the memory will be there. Eyes will become kind and deep, and the bones of this nation will mend after the revolution.
Roxanne, you wrote a particularly striking paragraph towards the end of your book on the United States' legacy of settler colonialism. I wonder if you would read it for us.
Yes, I write, in the United States, the legacy of settler colonialism can be seen in the endless wars of aggression and occupation, the trillions spent on war machinery, military bases, and personnel instead of social services and quality public education, the gross profits of corporations, each of which has greater resources and funds than more than half the countries in the world, yet pay minimal taxes and provide few jobs for U.S. citizens, the repression of generation after generation of activists who seek to change the system, the incarceration of the poor, particularly descendants of enslaved Africans, the individualism carefully inculcated that on the one hand produces self-blame for personal failure and on the other exalts ruthless dog-eat-dog competition for possible success, even though it rarely results, and the high rates of suicide, drug abuse, alcoholism, sexual violence against women and children, homelessness, dropping out of school, and gun violence. These are symptoms, and there are many more, of a deeply troubled society, and they are not new.
As we draw to a close, it might be useful to let our listeners know some of the ideas that you mention in your book for how we could get beyond empire. And you mentioned start by honoring treaties. What else can we do?
Well, the treaties are really important to most Native peoples. We include treaties and agreements because those who don't have formal treaties have de facto agreements with the United States just because of United States policy kind of homogenizing everything. These treaties of, they go back even to the colonial era, but the treaties of peace and friendship, in particular in the plains and the west, west to the Rocky Mountains and then over the Rockies in between the Sierra and the Rockies, the inner mountain west and the plains. These people were resisting fiercely and only they didn't surrender, but they agreed to peace agreements that were very strongly negotiated by the Native people to retain a land bases large enough, their kind of buffalo, because they were people of the bison. After these treaties were made, 1864, 1868, following the U.S. Civil War, the United States proceeded to systematically wipe out the bison, the food fight, as they had just, burned the crops of the farming people, these nomadic people. They destroyed their life sustenance, their food supply, the bison. They had the army coming out and actually murdering the buffalo. 90 million bison killed within about 6-year period of time. They used to, for people riding on trains, so they would give everyone a rifle to shoot out the window. They're large targets, the bison, and they were practically tamed by the Native people, attracted by, various means to gather around people, and they were, considered a gift from the gods for the for many Native people. This then led to starvation, deprivation, the reservation system, and the eating away, the illegal taking of land that was guaranteed under the treaties. So you had very much like Israel, taking pieces of land here and there in the occupation. You had this great Sioux Nation, for instance, that covered most of North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Montana, and to Minnesota, all contiguous, all one people. And it was broken down into 9 very small reservations, very impoverished, which it is today. So the reconstitution of those land bases and creating life estates for the settler descendants, the government can pay them off. Say, okay, when this generation is gone, this goes back to the Native people, and you will get this sum of money. That's how these things are done, and so it's absolutely doable. These are fairly sparsely populated places. There's a guarantee in legislation under the New Deal, what was called the Indian New Deal, that reconstituted Native governments in 1934, the Indian Reorganization Act, that the United States was obligated to any land that contiguous to any reservation that came up for sale, that the United States had to buy it for and put it in trust for the Native nation. They did that in a very few cases early on, but then with the reactionary 50s, they stopped doing that and did the opposite. And then Congress passed the Termination Act. It was actually called that, Indian Termination, to do away with all land bases. Well, this created a huge revolt among Native people, and they stopped that. but several Native nations were terminated and had to fight for their reconstitution. That is the main demand. Land base, nationhood, the ability to prosper and exist as people, you know, not just individuals being assimilated out. That's another form of genocide, you know, of disappearing people, even in the Genocide Convention, creating conditions that eliminate people as a people, not just individuals.
Well, we've been talking with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, whose new book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, published by Beacon Press, a very, very important history. Please read it. Roxanne, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
An insightful book. Thank you, Roxanne.
Thank you both.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The Board of Trustees at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign formalized the firing of tenured American Indian Studies professor Stephen Salida. He had been dehired weeks before by University Chancellor Phyllis Wise, who summarily dismissed him without faculty consultation. It was claimed at the time that the reason for Salida's dismissal was his, quote, uncivil, end quote, tweets on his Twitter account, which he issued during the Israeli 50-day massacre in Gaza. It has come to light under a local newspaper Freedom of Information request that emails within the University of Illinois revealed that it was outside financial and Zionist pressure on the university that caused them to dehire Salida. We're joined today by Professor Stephen Salida. We're joined today with Professor Stephen Salida, who no longer has neither a job nor a home and is living with his in-laws outside of Washington, D.C. Also joining us as a co-host for this interview is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, the distinguished scholar of indigenous peoples and the author of the recent An Indigenous People's History of the United States. Professor Stephen Salida, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
How are you?
Doing well, keeping in good spirits, ready to keep going.
A lot of our audience knows the story because we've been discussing it. We all think that this is probably the most crucial free speech and academic freedom case to come along, really in 50 years since the free speech movement out in Berkeley. And I wanted to start off by asking you, what happened to you? Last November, you signed a contract. You were teaching at Virginia Tech. You were a tenured professor there. Your wife had a job there. You had a one-year-old baby. You had health insurance. And you signed a contract with the University of Illinois to move to Champaign-Urbana and take on a tenured professorship as an associate professor in their Indian Studies program. And you're getting ready to move, and all of a sudden, the rug was pulled out from under you and your family. Tell us what happened to you, and we can then follow up with what we're going to do about it.
Sure. Well, you know, you actually gave quite a good summary. I was interviewing in late winter 2013, and I received the job offer actually at the end of September of the same year, signed the contract in early October, in fact. And so It was around a six-month vetting process. It was an extremely intensive vetting process, as is the norm when a university, especially a large research university like UIUC, is going to hire somebody with tenure. So everything was good. They wanted actually the first offer was for me to begin on January 1st, 2014, but because of my obligations at Virginia Tech and the short time frame for moving, we went ahead and pushed it back until mid-August, a little bit more than, 6 months later. Everything was good to go. We had set up movers. I had my classes ready to teach. They'd been assigned to me. I had ordered my textbooks. I had written my syllabi. Everything was good to go. And then on August 2nd, which was a Saturday, I received a letter from the chancellor of the campus, Phyllis Wise, informing me that the termination was going to be withdrawn. And, so it sort of left me scrambling for what to do at that point, because I'd already resigned my tenured position at Virginia Tech. So all of a sudden, I didn't have a job anymore at either Illinois or Virginia Tech. And anybody who knows anything about academe knows that it's impossible to get a position, particularly a tenured position, right, within 3 weeks. It's a year-long process. So they left me in a very difficult situation.
Why was this done to you? What was it that caused the chancellor, without consultation with the academic bodies that vetted you and hired you, why was it that this was done to you?
Well, publicly released documents, ever since the firing, indicate that donor pressure played a large role in it. There has been some consternation about my tweets about Operation Protective Edge. That's Israel's recent invasion of the Gaza Strip, and I think that had a lot to do with it, the donor pressure. I think the university administration is sort of pressing this idea of incivility in social media. So it seems pretty clear at this point that donor pressure, right, from pro-Israel individuals and groups largely, that the administration basically caved in to that sort of lobbying.
Let me understand this. You're tweeting on social media, on your private social media, on your own time, outside of the classroom, outside of the academic context, and somebody's monitoring your tweets. And they bring this to the attention of people who are donating money to the university, regardless of your free speech rights and the rights of the students on the campus to hear what you have to say, and the rights of the faculty who hired you. They just fire you? Is that accurate in a nutshell?
That appears to be the case, yes.
We have a guest host today, your friend Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, who herself is a distinguished scholar of Native American history. We thought that her interests and yours academically and politically overlap so well. We've just interviewed her about her new book, and we wanted her to stay in the studio and be a guest host with us to speak with you. And Roxanne, you had something to say?
Yes, and thank you for allowing me to be guest host with Stephen, whom I admire so much. Stephen, what really offended me the most, and I think the Native American community, is that you were hired in Native American Studies, which is the most prestigious Native American studies in the country. It has started the Native American Indigenous Studies Association and its new journal. Very prestigious, and you were brought in as a very prestigious hire to teach Native American Studies, which is what you studied at University of Oklahoma. And they were not even consulted with this firing. And, of course, they have voted no confidence, as have several other departments at University of Illinois. But wasn't that just shocking to you and really racist?
It was shocking to, and it remains shocking to a lot of people, not least, the folks in the American Indian Studies program. And it's a pretty small unit, I think 8 or 9 full-time faculty. But, as you say, Roxanne, it's extremely distinguished. The scholars there are just terrific writers and thinkers and teachers. I think one of the saddest parts about, the whole affair is that I haven't had the opportunity to, to join them and become their colleague and work with them, because it's just a terrific group of people. And they've been terrific throughout this entire affair. I've been thinking a lot about how that sort of functions, and I think that if listeners, may not be aware, but academic hiring happens at the level of faculty. It happens at the level of the department, and departments will, search committees within departments will choose a hire. Sometimes the entire department has to sign off on it. Sometimes a personnel committee, sometimes the chair. Then it gets kicked up to the dean, and then it'll get kicked up to the provost or chancellor, And so that's kind of, for their approval. And that's kind of how it works. And so that's what we call, shared governance or democratic governance on campus, because the boards of trustees and the presidents and chancellors are really concerned with the business end of the university. They're not supposed to interject themselves into the process of academic hiring, right? Or only in extraordinary circumstances, which this doesn't qualify for. And it's kind of an allegory of the position of American Indian nations in the United States and Canada more generally, right? That they're seen as not being able to make their own autonomous decisions. They're not allowed to articulate, their own practices of sovereignty without the oversight of authorities above them who are wiser and more responsible. And to add to that, the discourse that they used in firing me is remarkable. I don't know how aware of it they are or not, but to describe somebody who's been hired by an American Indian Studies department as uncivil draws on hundreds of years of colonial discourses, that I find shocking. The idea that that they're willing to name publicly the native and indigenous faculty as uncivil and as being complicit in incivility, right? Whereas the administrators, those from on high in positions of authority, have a more responsible sense of what it is that this community should be doing.
I can't describe to you the grin on both of our faces. It reminded me of when George Bush Jr. described what they were doing in the Middle East as a crusade. Let me ask you a personal question, if I might, Steve. You're a descendant from Palestinians, and you, in your scholarship, make the connection between the genocide against Native Americans here in the United States and the genocide that's going on against Palestinians at the hands of the Israelis in the Middle East. And I wanted to talk to you about that. Do you think that was a factor in your being fired?
I think so. I think it was easier in general for the administration to take the step that it did because it was an American Indian Studies program. And we have to understand that at the University of Illinois, there's a pretty long history of that American Indian Studies program sort of being on the margin because of its vocal opposition to the Chief Illini Wick mascot. And so, in a lot of people's eyes in central Illinois, and I think in a lot of administrators' eyes, both past and present, that department has been something of a nuisance. It's been sort of organizing around issues of decolonization, not just around the chief, but around other things. And it's kind of gotten the reputation as a collective of troublemakers, completely ridiculous reputation. But there it is. I think a lot of people in the community sort of see them as agitators, right, and as people who sort of try to undermine the sacred cows of colonial identity. But that was the reason that I was hired, was to make those connections, to help sort of move the department in a more global, international, intercultural direction, right? In fact, the job talk that I gave during my on-campus interview was on internationalism in indigenous studies and sort of drawing these connections. I think it's also easy to dismiss somebody of Palestinian background as uncivil and as being intellectually incapable of running a productive classroom environment when that person is also sort of being situated in the context of a group of indigenous scholars. I think the connections are there; they're clear. It's kind of an allegory of history and politics that exists in microcosmic form, right, within the framework of the University of Illinois.
This long struggle against the chief and that mascot, and of course, Charlene Teeter's demonstrations on campus that led to the establishment of American Indian Studies there as a kind of you know, militant oppositional force. And a lot of people, I'm pretty sure, quite a few on that board and the fans of the football team have not forgiven American Indians for taking their chief away, just like the Washington team and their offensive name. But yeah, I thought it was very, just very courageous and committed of you to, you know, really want to support American Indian Studies and bring that kind of prestige. It hasn't always been popular with Palestinians to identify with Native Americans, even though Yasser Arafat and the PLO got us started in the United Nations as an indigenous lobby and supported us, you know, throughout the 70s and 80s. And we have identified so much with Palestinians, and now that's happening in the Palestinian community. And this was just such a great opportunity, and it's so disappointing. You have to get that job back, Steve.
Well, you know, I would love nothing more. And, you know, to respond just briefly, that it's been one of the greatest honors of my life to sort of taken in by my indigenous brethren and working with such loving and intelligent, welcoming people who are committed to doing critical scholarship that has material consequences, you know, to doing work that is both intellectually rigorous and engaged with the communities that it studies. You know, these are things that I absolutely love about the field and things that I think those who are interested in Palestine can deeply identify with.
Stephen, you said at your press conference 3 weeks ago that this was, quote, a teaching moment. What is it precisely that you would like to teach us about this moment?
About the importance, first of all, of sustaining academic freedom and faculty governance or shared governance. I think it's also important that we take a look at the direction that a lot of universities are moving in, and that is top-down authoritarian governance. Business people who are occupying boards of trustees are making decisions regarding faculty hiring, and that's troublesome. People who aren't actually qualified to make these sorts of decisions, they simply don't have the credentials, or interjecting themselves into faculty search processes. And this not only undermines faculty governance, but it puts a serious damper on, you know, the very notion of expertise, and is a real detriment to the long training that we have to undergo to even get PhDs and enter into the field in the first place. I think it's also important for us, you know, as our teaching moment to, you know, as scholars, students, community members, to try to closely analyze what it means to engage in civil discourse. I think it's pretty clear that in this case, civility means acquiescence to power, right? And I think incivility equates to dissent. And, you know, I think it's crucial that we continue examining these commonplace terms and unpacking their actual meanings and seeing how they function, right, in the new corporatization of our campuses.
What kind of support has come forward to work with you in teaching these points and to stand with you in your defense?
The response has been overwhelming, and it's just been stunning for me. It's been heartening. You know, it's made me, despite the hardships, happy to be alive. It's just been tremendous. You know, nearly 6,000 individual scholars are boycotting UIUC until it reverses course. 16 departments on that campus have voted no confidence in the system president, Robert Easter, you know, Phyllis Wise, and the Board of Trustees. You know, a lot of strong organizations have taken up my case. The AAUP, the Center for Constitutional Rights, who's also representing me in this matter, the Modern Language Association, the American Studies Association. So there are a lot of quote unquote heavy hitters in the academic and civil rights world who are interested in my case. And then just on a personal level, you know, people have been remarkably generous, knowing that, that I don't have income anymore. My spouse resigned her job. Also, she had a good job at Virginia Tech in preparation for the move to Illinois. You know, we don't have health insurance. We have a young son. You know, so people have just been extraordinarily personally generous in offering what we need to make sure that, that we have a roof over our heads and food in our bellies. So, you know, there's I think that in lots of ways my case has become something of an avatar or a flashpoint for people's grievances about the way that universities are being run in undemocratic ways.
I'm certainly hoping it's a turning point where that consciousness is really is clarified. Do you think that there's any connection between the American Studies Association and the Native American and Indigenous Studies Association last fall endorsing the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement against the academic part of it? And I know that you advocated that too, but more as a symbol of a kind of payback for that, because there was a lot, you know, not a lot of dissension, but very angry, revengeful kinds of attitudes on the part of a number of university presidents and deans and so forth about it. Do you think there's any, you know, that you're kind of a symbol of that anger in a way, a target?
Mm-hmm. You know, Roxanne, there's no hard evidence that that's been the case so far, but, you know, my suspicion is that very well could be the case. You know, when the American Studies Association last December voted overwhelmingly, by the way, to adhere to the academic boycott, the call from Palestinian civil society against Israeli universities and institutions, it really shook up academe, and there was tons of debate about it. And I was very much in the forefront as somebody who was writing in support of that resolution, so I could really be easily identified with BDS. And I think within the past year, two things have happened that have caused Zionists to step up their game around this issue. And one is the string of boycott resolutions that have been ratified by scholarly organizations, by labor unions, by civil rights groups, et cetera, by churches. You know, there have been a lot of institutions inside and outside of academe that have signed on to some form of boycott against Israel. And then the second thing is you know, Operation Protective Edge, in which Israel really took a pounding, even in the mainstream press, in ways that it was normally immune to. And I think those two things put together, right, have generated a sense of fear or panic among Israel's supporters. And I think their response to it is not to engage with the issues, not to have conversations or debates about the issues, but to shut down our side altogether, right? They don't want to have debates. They want to silence. They don't want to engage in conversation. They want the discussion to be unilateral. And so I do believe, even though there's no hard evidence, that my visibility even before the job offer as somebody who was a vocal supporter of BDS and academic boycott certainly probably gave, you know, my detractors additional motivation.
I think that pro-Israel watchdogs were keeping track of you, Steve. And as Catherine Franke has pointed out, your victimization was just the latest iteration in a long line of people who have expressed solidarity with the Palestinians. And after they got you fired, it came out that this AMCHA organization, which is funded by that great humanitarian Sheldon Adelson, the man who took Mitt Romney to Jerusalem, AMCHA was keeping track of a listserv of professors around Brandeis University who were concerned about the massacre in Gaza and the victimization of Palestinians. And they published the names. It's just right out of McCarthy. Here I've got a list of 225 names of these professors. And then 2 weeks before that, they managed to get the Episcopal chaplain at Yale fired for a 3-sentence letter that he wrote to the New York Times saying what is an obvious truth, that he thought that the massacre in Gaza was partly responsible for the uptick in anti-Semitism in Europe. And for that opinion, he lost his job. So I think these people are institutionalized, the AMCHA organization, the David Project, Stand With Us Project, and they're keeping tabs on people like you or me or Roxanne, and using their considerable power to try to stifle us. It's so heartening to hear the kind of support that you're getting, because I think people understand that what's happening in Israel, this unfolding genocide, and I think more people are understanding that's exactly what it is, and it has blowback in the United States with the stifling of free speech here. So I think that is really the reason that, I mean, apart from your stellar self, an admirable self, but that's the political reason why so much support is coming out.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's the case. I mean, I don't want to downplay just the extraordinary amount of personal empathy that I've received, but I think a lot of folks also, and I do too, conceptualize this as not specifically about me, right? We've entered into the realm of the symbolic in lots of ways, right? We know that if we keep allowing these pro-Israel forces to shut us down without taking a stand and winning one of these profile cases, then it sets a horrible precedent for all of us in the future.
We really do have to make this a test case because it is, you know, Michael mentioned McCarthyism, and you're too young to remember personally the kind of stifling of speech that this had, where people self-censored. And that's what's happening a lot now, people self-censoring about even bringing up the issue of Palestine or Israel, because it simply marks you, you know, and it can hurt you in not just in academia but in any kind of career or getting a fellowship or anything. And it's got to be stopped before it gets out of hand.
Absolutely. And I take my cue, as I know so many of us do, from, you know, the indigenous peoples in Central and South America, right, in Southern Mexico and Chiapas, you know, in North America, the Palestinians, other indigenous and colonized people who risk tremendous personal harm, you know, to stand up for justice. And it's I think, our duty and our responsibility to stand with them and to do the same thing and to not be cowed by forces that wish to shut us down or wish to do us harm. They don't give up. We can't give up.
Absolutely. Stephen, before we say goodbye, because we're about to run out of time, is there a website? Is there somewhere where people can go if they want to come to your support?
There is a support Salida page on Facebook that has wonderful information. Administrators have done like an amazing job. And there's also a supportsalida.wordpress.com site that has information about the case, articles, links to donate, these sorts of things.
Great. Well, thank you very much on behalf of Roxanne and Michael Ratner, who's off at the European Center for Human Rights in Germany, and Heidi Boghossian and Roxanne. We're very grateful for your coming on the show, Steve, and you have our solidarity and support. We look forward to your trip to New York City starting on November 17th for a week. And in the meantime, keep your spirits up.
I will. It's my honor and pleasure. Thank you so much.
Bye, Steve.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.